for Morris versus Barnhart.
Good morning, Your Honor. Michael Sperling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, appearing on behalf of the...
If you find the lectern too high, there's a little switch. You can just lower the whole lectern.
I think I'm okay.
Don't play with the microphone.
I'm sorry. Lower the lectern. Okay, I think I'm okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Sometimes I've had that problem with being a little bit short here. I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I represent the appellant, Marvin Morris. This is a Social Security disability matter, and Mr. Morris... currently 62 years old. At the time of his hearings, he was 55 and 59 years old. The issue here is whether the administrative law judge's decision is supported by substantial evidence. And the issue before you, Your Honors, is whether Mr. Morris could do his past work, and specifically as a civilian telecommunications specialist for the Milwaukee Police Department. The law is clear, as I understand it, as far as what's required for substantial evidence. What's required is that the administrative law judge cannot simply ignore material pieces of evidence that favor the claimant, which was done in this case. Additionally, his decision can't be based on errors of fact, which was also done in this case. Also, his reasoning has to hold together. I don't think the reasoning of the administrative law judge held together in this case. The administrative law judge ignores substantial pieces of evidence. Mr. Morris is someone who worked for 24 years as a police officer for the Rockford Police Department, and then he went on disability pension, so he could not do that job anymore. Came back a couple years later and got a job in Milwaukee as a civilian telecommunications specialist, which generally required answering the telephone and typing continually when people called in and said that they have a problem, 911 calls or non-911 calls. You have to type continually the information when people called in. The problem here was that Mr. Morris had this job for 4 years. After a couple years, the problem that he had for some years, a shoulder and numbness to his hand, started to act up. Mr. Morris wrote a resignation letter to the Milwaukee Police Department, which said, due to increasing pains in my right shoulder, arms, and fingers, this is why he had to resign. This is caused by too much typing. This is an old injury I received while I was an officer with the Rockford Police Department. Over the last 2.5 years, it has become increasingly more and more a problem for me, where now the fingers of my right hand go numb later in the day. Mr. Morris tried to work. He absolutely attempted to work. He took vacation days. He did what he could to keep doing this job, but he had numbness, which came from this injury that he had, which originally came from arresting someone in 1985 as a police officer. And it should be also known that Mr. Morris did have surgery. This letter, which I think is strong evidence, this resignation letter, why he couldn't do that job, is strong evidence as to that he couldn't do his past job. That essentially was ignored by the ALJ here. The numbness, he talks about he had numbness going into his hands. Now, that evidence is essentially also not taken into account by the administrative law judge. There's essentially no comment. There's two doctors here in this case. There's a treating doctor, Dr. Van Winkle, and there's a consultative examiner for Social Security, Dr. Evanich. Both these doctors gave opinions that there was Mr. Morris had numbness going into his hands. That originally came from a shoulder, this shoulder surgery he had, this rotator cuff injury. The ALJ ignored that evidence completely. All he says in his decision is that Mr. Morris complained
that. That evidence is ignored? Isn't it subsumed in the question whether your client can engage in fine manipulation with his hands?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, I think the issue of fine tuning manipulation, yes, maybe he can do something for a period of time, pick up something for a period of time, but the issue really is, can he do this? Can he do this throughout the entire day? You can still have fine finger manipulation.
Is that your view or is that the physician's view?
Physician,
when a physician says somebody can engage in fine manipulation, what does that mean?
That means to me that he can fix something.
No, I'm not asking what it means to you. What does it mean to the physician? That is, how do we know what that statement means? Your position, I think, has to boil down to, when a physician says he can engage in fine manipulation, he means only for an instant and not for an extended period. Now, how do we know that that's what such a statement means?
I don't think that statement, unfortunately, I don't think that statement goes one way or the other as to what happens in this case. The issue, we don't know what, it goes only as far as it goes. It goes to...
No, I'm asking a generic question. Is this a defined term? Is there some place we can look up to see what fine manipulation means, to see whether it means for an instant or over time?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that's just something that physicians will say this is what it is. It doesn't talk about whether this is something that goes on. As I understand it, no. I don't think it's anything you look up which in the Social Security rulings or in case law or anything like that. It talks about what a fine finger manipulation is. The problem here is that you can say you can define finger manipulation, but if you have to type continually for an entire day and you're doing this for the whole day, yes, you may get numbness in your hands. And we have treating doctors and a consultative examiner who's Ted. He gets numbness in his fingers. He gets in his second, third, and fourth fingers. That's what the consultative examiner says, called paresthesis is what he says, because he gets numbness in his hands. And the treating doctor says the same thing. Both those treating doctors' opinions are ignored. You can't do that. You can't ignore evidence like that and make a decision. You have to at least deal with it. The ALJ essentially pretends that doesn't exist.
That's my problem. If when a physician says X can engage in fine manipulation, it just means X can engage in small finger movements all day, then nothing has been ignored. Just the case that the record is solidly against your client. If, on the other hand, the physician's statement about fine manipulation means he can do it for 30 seconds, beyond that I say nothing, then indeed evidence has been ignored. And that drives me back to the question, how do we know which it means?
I don't think we know, but we have other... I don't think we know one way or the other what that exactly means, Your Honor.
But maybe we just have to take the inference in the light most favorable to the administrative record.
I don't think so, Your Honor.
If there's no way of knowing whether your position is correct, why isn't there substantial evidence to support the decision?
But I think there's a distinction between fine finger manipulation and between numbness and paresthesia.
Yeah, but look, that's my problem. It's not important what you think. Problem is, what do the physicians think? What does this mean objectively? This is not lawyer talk, it's physician talk.
Your Honor, the physicians discussed this issue. They discussed, in their opinion, they discussed that he was having paresthesia in his fingers, he was having numbness in his fingers. That's something in addition to fine finger manipulation. They talk about this, and they talk about that this is out there, and this is, and so that, if that's there, that's going to cause him a problem in doing his job of typing. And typing may be something distinguished from fine finger manipulation. You may be able to pick up pennies off a table, that's fine finger manipulation. But trying to type all day is something substantially different. Additionally, the administrative law judge ignores the issue of that he just pretends like he doesn't have to type all day. It's undisputed he has to type all day for this job. There's absolutely no issue regarding that. And the ALJ pretends that it's not there. He tried to do the job. The evidence is there that he tried to do the job. There's physician evidence that he can't. He has numbness and paresthesia that's been ignored. He has to deal with those issues. He has to talk about those issues. He just can't pretend that they're no longer there. The ALJ talks about medication. The ALJ also says that he has, in his view, that there's a kind of minimal problem here. It's not really a disabling problem. The ALJ says he wasn't taking anti-inflammatory medications. He's just dead wrong. He was taking anti-inflammatory medications in 91, in 93, in 95, and the evidence is in the record. It's in the brief.
Aren't the majority of these credibility determinations?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Aren't the majority of these credibility
determinations? They're not, Your Honor. I mean, you can make first of all, on the credibility issue, the judge doesn't say he's not credible. The judge says he's not entirely credible.
He doesn't explain
where he's credible and where he's not credible. He just said he's not entirely credible or not totally credible. Those are the ALJ's terms.
he was not totally credible, seemed to suggest that the ALJ credited his testimony to some degree.
Right, we don't know what, we don't know how he credited. That's part. We have to explain his reasoning. We don't know how if he credited in one way or if he credited another way. We don't know what he, what the ALJ meant. But these aren't credibility. When you ignore certain evidence, when you misstate the evidence. For example, if you say the ALJ said that he couldn't, the ALJ said he took no anti-inflammatory or pain medication prior to 1997. That's just flat wrong. He took Daypro in 1991. To Voltaren in 1993, he was continued on Daypro in 1995. He uses that. He just misstates. You can't. First of all, you can't ignore evidence, and you can't totally misstate evidence, especially when you're relying on that evidence to come to a conclusion.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. I'm just asking that the court reverse or that remand for further proceedings.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right.
May I please the court? I'm Melinda Hammond. Excuse me, I'm Melinda Hammond representing Commissioner Bartok. The appellant argues that the ALJ's findings that he can perform the crucial functions, in this case, fine manipulation and typing. The ALJ's finding is not supported because the ALJ didn't find that numbness or paresthesias caused manipulative limitations. The appellant's argument is premised on two assumptions. First, that the complaints of numbness and pain and typing were credible. And second, that the clinical findings called for some functional limitation on typing ability. However, the ALJ properly evaluated the credibility of the appellant's subjective complaints, and the medical opinions of record refute his assumption that the clinical findings mandated manipulative limitations. First, with regard to the credibility of the appellant's allegations of numbness and pain on typing, the ALJ specifically addressed the claim of numbness in his fingers at transcript page 131, but he discounted it because of the nature of the appellant's treatment, the finding regarding his hands on examination, and the nature of the medication he took, and the doctor's opinions that this person can perform fine and gross manipulation. Second, both the opinions...
Well, I have the same question for you as I had for your adversary. When a physician says X can engage in fine manipulation, does that mean he can pick up something now, or does it mean he can do it for 8 hours?
The term fine manipulation is not defined as a term of art by the Social Security or Department of Labor. The form this particular physician filled out is not a Social Security form, but the form he filled out sets out certain assumptions that in this case indicate that this person can perform repetitive fine manipulation over the course of an 8-hour day. And those are the terms that the in the form the physician was filling out, those are the assumptions that his check-the-box mark of yes assumed. So in this case, we believe that the nature of that form supports the ALJ's finding, the doctor's opinion in that form supports the finding that he can perform fine manipulation with no restrictions over the course of the 8-hour day repetitively.
It says that in the form?
Yes, Your Honor. Page 85. At the top it says, before
page 85 of what?
The transcript. The administrative transcript. It says that in an 8-hour workday, the claimant can, and then it starts to list the different functions. And near the bottom of the form, it says in all caps, it says, claimant can use hands for repetitive actions such as, and then it gives spaces for simple grasping, pushing and pulling of arm controls, and fine manipulation. And it has both yes and no for right and left upper extremities in all of those categories. And the physician checked yes for both hands in fine manipulation defined repetitively. And additionally, the form has at the bottom of it a space for remarks or other functional restrictions. And Dr. Van Winkle took the time to make some comments in that space, but didn't mention anything about additional limitations on the time this person could perform manipulations or any kind of dexterous action.
Now, is there step three. This is the BE, I guess, determined that he could, given these doctor's reports, that he could perform his past work. And my curiosity here is that had he not, I mean, would, if we get on to step five, it sounds, are there other disabilities that maybe this is the only thing he can do?
At step five, the record becomes unclear. This person could do a limited range. His exertional level was between light and sedentary, so he would not, the outcome wouldn't be controlled by either one of the medical vocational guidelines. And it also varies depending on his age. He, at the earlier point in the relevant period, he was closely approaching advanced age, which is one category. Once he turned 55, he was of advanced age. And then also another variable in this case that's outcome determinative is transferability of skills. If he has transferable skills, even at advanced age, even at sedentary work only, he could be found not disabled. The VE gave some testimony that may indicate there are transferable skills.
But I'm curious if this, if for some reason the record didn't show that he could do his, what do they call it, past relevant work or something, mm-hmm. then the cases we usually go on to the fifth step, and they can be a one-night watchman and a few other things. It's kind of an easy hurdle for the government to prove, unless there's something, this is all he can do.
I don't believe the ALJ took sort of backup testimony from the VE, and the grids are not clear. They don't mandate a finding. Okay. I'd also like to point out that the ALJ fulfilled the requirements of Social Security Ruling 8262 to make specific findings of fact about the RFC, residual functional capacity, about the physical and mental demands of the past occupation, and whether the residual functional capacity would permit a return to the person's past job. The ALJ made a very detailed finding of fact on residual functional capacity. He didn't just conclude shorthand sedentary work, but he specifically listed the lifting, standing, sitting, walking, and the various manipulative abilities of this person. In formal finding 8, the ALJ found that past relevant work as a telecommunications person required the claimant to answer the telephone and type. These are the only significant job duties that the appellant identified, and this finding was an appropriate finding of fact regarding the physical and mental demands. Finally, also in formal finding 8, the ALJ concluded that appellant's past work did not require the performance of work-related activities precluded by his residual functional capacity, meeting the third specific finding of fact requirement in the 1982 ruling. The ALJ properly found that appellant could perform his past relevant work as it was normally performed in the national economy, and substantial vocational evidence supports this finding that the job as it was normally performed could be performed by someone with appellant's RFC. The ALJ used the vocational expert's testimony to compare the RFC to the requirements of the job as it's normally performed. The VE testified that a person limited, as limited by the physicians in this case, could perform the telecommunicator job, and he gathered his information about the job from the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, as well as other publications of the Department of Labor and the Census. This expert testimony provides substantial evidence that the appellant with the RFC as found by the ALJ could perform his past relevant work as it was normally performed, and therefore it was not disabled. If there are no questions, I'll sit down.
Frank? Frank, do you want to ask anything? Dan? That's all, and thank you. Does he have any time? Right.